This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this very special episode of the Curzon Film Podcast, where we will discuss the highlights of the London Film Festival 2016. I'm Sam Howlett and this week I'm joined by Jake Cunningham.
Hiya.
So throughout the episode, me, Jake, as well as various people from the Curzon and Artificial Eye head office will discuss our favourite films at the festival this year. Should we start?
Yeah, we might as well.
So the opening film of the festival this year was Emma Asante's United Kingdom, her follow-up to Belle. It starred David Oyelowo and Rosamund Pike. He plays the King of Bechuanaland. She plays a white woman from London. They fall in love. True story. How did you think the film played?
Yeah, I think it's one of those films like Testament of Youth, in that people said Testament of Youth was like, it's a kind of cliche war romance. You think, yeah, but like that was the text that generated so many films that and stories that were a copycat of it, that ultimately when it kind of felt cliched when it came out. We see a lot of race relations films coming out perhaps around the Oscar season, and we think, oh, it's a bit kind of twee and it's a bit gunning for awards. And I think this film managed to handle that quite well. It never feels like it's kind of pandering to an audience. The story feels like it needed to be told. It feels like you're watching it and you think, why don't I know this?
Yeah. Definitely. I thought that though, there's a few films out there this year based on true stories, and each time I saw one, I think, why don't people know about this story? Yeah. But that's just good filmmaking, I suppose, as well, making you believe the story really happened and making you feel like you should read more into it. I think the film's really solid.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. It's really solid.
It's not going to change the world. It's not a technical feat. It's not got the most amazing performances or most complex characters, but it's just a very, very sort of, important... fun at times, enjoyable, emotional. It's just everything you want from an opening film.
Yeah, and I think you say there's no standout performances. I think David Oyelowo is very good in it.
He is very good, but I can't see this getting much awards recognition.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a film that's in the same kind of vein as Suffragette from last year.
Which also opened the festival last year, and
Yeah, and it does. It's got star power. It's got a political message. It's got a historical message. It's a period piece. It does all the things that you want out of a film at Oscar season. But I don't think it's too cliched in that fact.
I think we should point out now for this and all the films that a lot of them we are going to do full shows on when they are eventually released.
Yeah.
So that's why we're just doing these little capsule reviews, not in too much detail. We will do a full United Kingdom review when that comes out.
Yeah, and during the festival, we managed to speak to Emma Asante about the film and her previous film, Belle. So I think that's around the end of November that will be coming out, so you'll be able to listen to that.
Great. So we're now going to go to a person who works in the Artificial Eye head office. This is Kate Kane, and she will talk about Heal the Living, Graduation, and Manchester by the Sea.
So, Kate, take it away.
Okay, well, I have to balance it out with stuff that's ours, along with stuff which I've seen, which is already sold for the UK, because I think that's fair.
Yeah.
But two of my favourite films of ours. We had loads of films in the NFF because we buy a lot in Cannes.
Yeah.
But Heal the Living, which we bought in Venice, which is a proper gym, and it's just starting to go on their festival route, which has just had an amazing response from the critics and from audiences. And it's, when I pitch it, you'll think, no, but trust me.
Okay.
So it's a story about organ donation, and I realise as I'm saying it, that doesn't sound right. It's a story about two families and about how you stay complete, and it's about the importance of life and all these big sort of questions, but it's beautifully done. Mm. And we released her last film, Love Like Poison. Actually, not her last film, but we did one of her previous films called Love Like Poison. And she's this French filmmaker called Catel Cavillier, who she's an emotional filmmaker, and she tells stories that really affect you. Like, everybody cried at the screening, that kind of stuff. She's visceral. So it starts off with this amazing surfing scene, because it's like the boy at the very start, and the camera sort of goes with the surfboard, and you get this really energetic, you know, you really feel how full his life is, and he's on the skateboard and doing all these things, and it's beautiful, and the energy's going, and then it's not giving anything away to say there's this spectacular crash scene, and then from there it's about his parents dealing with the grief of him being brain dead, and then it goes on from there. So she's really good at moving the tone around in a way that doesn't ever feel that it's not part of the storyline. It doesn't feel inauthentic. But you do feel like you go from one emotion to the other, and it's just a beautiful piece of cinema. And we immediately knew when we saw it in Venice that we had to buy it because it's just fresh, classic, at the same time filmmaking from someone who really knows how to tell a story. So
the director's name is
there's lots and lots of letters in her surname, and I'm not French, so I will say it wrong, but it's Catel Cavillier, Q-U-I-L-L, and lots of other letters, but the French people here know how to pronounce it. So there's that, and that was also in Toronto, so then it's in London, and then I think we're going to release it second half of next year.
Second half of 2017. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So that's Heal the Living.
Yep. And then another one of ours, which we bought in Cannes, which was my favourite film in Cannes, was Graduation, which is the Christian Mungiu, who did 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, and Beyond the Hills. This is probably his most accessible. And it's really, it's a critique of Romanian politics and about this whole generation who've been lost by... But, you know, all the stuff that was happening sort of 15, 20 years ago, which means that all their ambitions and everything that they wanted to do. And so in the same way that Leviathan was this sort of allegory of Russian political strife, it does the same thing, but he does it in his own particular way. It's beautifully written. It's nuanced. It's subtle, and you watch it and you just... I could have watched it again. I could have gone out the cinema and gone back in and watched it again, because there was just so much going on. But it doesn't feel, you know, in the way when you see a separation, you're just like, this is incredible. And our head of press saw it the other day, and he just said halfway through, he was like, this is it. Like, this is why you work where we work, because it's just subtle, nuanced, layered filmmaking that... Romanian New Wave is supposed to be this big new thing now, where it's, you know, it's really on a roll, and I think he's at the forefront of it. There was this film, and there was another film called Sierra Nevada, which is by Christian Pugh, which is again really talky, beautifully layered, but I just, for me, this has an extra layer. This just has that, it's emotional, and it's about a girl who, she's a daughter, and she's doing her exams just before she goes to Oxford or Cambridge University, and she's attacked and she breaks her arm, and it makes it difficult for her to do her exams. And so then there's this thing of everything hinges on this one moment for her exams, and she's traumatized, and the dad is trying to go through back channels in order to help her do it. But it's about his ambition for her being really about replicating, about wanting a better life for her. And it's just it's just, it, for me, it's almost perfect.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, I loved it. And so it's at the festival, it was at the festival here, and I know that it is 5-star reviews, all that kind of stuff. It's just, it's classic foreign language storytelling that's for an intelligent audience. So I'm really, really happy we have that.
Great.
And then the final one.
Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, okay, all right. You're gonna have to stop me talking about this one at some point, because Manchester by the Sea is the perfect, perfect story of grief and about, not exactly redemption, but about how you come back from trauma. And it, Kenneth Lonergan is this filmmaker who, I think he's made the film, like, this is his film, this is his, you know, every filmmaker has one that's supposed to be your stamp. And for me, he's got, in a lead actor with Casey Affleck, he's got the most, he's the good Affleck brother. He conveys with his eyes this sense of loss and this sense of grief, and it's in his body language, and it's in, you know, he goes up against Michelle Williams and he outperforms Michelle Williams, like, it's completely natural. And so I don't want to give too much away about what happens, because there's time cuts and jumps and flashbacks and all that kind of stuff, but it's about how you can come back from it and finding your family and finding your place, and about how you can never really run away from your past. But Kenneth Lonergan is someone who just puts the camera there, and it just feels like he just happens to capture this thing that happens, but it's just in every scene. So whether he's on the boat and he's playing with his nephew and his brother, Carl Chandler, who's in it, who they have this, just this spark between them, and it feels like a real family, and it feels like he's just on the boat with his brother and his nephew and everything's fine. And then you jump forward in time, and then he's in a completely different place, and you just, and he looks like a broken man, like he's, you know, everything about it. Kenneth Lonergan is just, I don't know how he does it. It's like he's done, he's painted different paintings, and one looks like a Matisse and one looks like a Rembrandt, and you know, it's just, I don't know how he manages to get this, all these different versions of one man. And I wept so hard in that film all the way through, but the last 15 minutes, and then I sort of came out and I wanted to call my brother and tell him, you know, I loved him. And you get other films like that, like Tony Erdmann, I came out of and I called my dad. And more, I came out of, I called both my parents, you know, like, they, when they get a phone call during a festival now, they're like, oh God, what is it? But for this one, for me, it's just, it's had 5-star reviews, it's deserved 5-star reviews, and I hope it becomes one of those films that people go and see in the cinema and tell their friends about, because his last film was a complicated matter, and it didn't get released. It got released, but like years later, and it didn't really work, and I think it's a shame. And I just think this film is so good, and it's really rare to come out. The last film I felt like this was like Whiplash, I think, where I just thought, this is just what cinema is, and this is why you pay to go and see a film, and this is why you feel this way. So,
great.
I'm sorry, I told you.
I agree with that. Yeah. It's one of my favourite films of the festival. Yeah. And it's really funny.
It is funny as well, and that's so unusual. Yeah. But it's got that, it's the real dynamic between them. It feels natural, and there's the,
Well, because like grief and humour are sometimes, you find them both at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, I get the giggles at funerals.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
So it sort of feels like that same thing. So I think, and then, you know, there's other films that I saw at the festival that, like La La Land, but I'm sure everybody will say La La Land, so I don't think it needs as much of a shout out, whereas for me, Kill the Living, Graduation and Manchester by the Sea are films that will get well reviewed and do have good audience reactions, but they need
a push.
They need a push, and I think this is what I like about festivals, you find a gem and then you shout about it and say, go and see this, and so, yeah.
Okay, so that was Kate Kane there. I really agree with everything she said about Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah, Manchester by the Sea, I think is an extremely well-made film.
Yeah.
You touched on it just at the end there. The thing that really got to me was that balance of grief and comedy and how much they go, that kind of morbid humour that you find at funerals.
Definitely.
And I was not expecting to laugh as much as I did during this film. But I think that's an important part of it.
Yeah, and it's just, it's got, when I've been describing this film to so many people, and when I say, oh, it's about a guy whose brother dies and then he has to look after his nephew, they go, oh, right, okay. It does sound like something you've seen before, but trust me, it's nothing like anything I've seen before, just in the way it deals with grief and sort of introspection. And Casey Affleck does an absolutely incredible performance, and it's a really great character as well, considering he doesn't really say that much.
No.
Yes, blew me away, this film.
Yeah, I think a nice companion piece to the Nick Cave documentary that came out earlier this year, in that grief is not a 7-step program or 5-step program, whatever people say, and you don't just go on this journey that everyone else goes on. It's confusing, it doesn't make sense, times it's farcical. But
there isn't a mourning period.
Yeah.
It's what it is.
And that idea of trying to pigeonhole people's grief into a specific routine is just ludicrous. And I think Manchester by the Sea really captures that.
Yeah. So Manchester by the Sea is out on the 13th of January 2017 here in the UK. And there was a film that played at the festival that I really wanted to see but couldn't quite get to it, and that was Raw, which is a horror film. It won Best First Feature at the Festival Awards on Saturday night. So I didn't see it, but Ryan Hewitt from Head Office did manage to see it, so here are his thoughts on Raw.
Raw is this much-talked-about, highly-buzzed horror film from Julia DeCorno. It is in French language. It has been picked up by Universal, I believe. And it is, the thing that everyone's saying is that it's truly disgusting and gory and repulsive to look at. There's stories of people having to be taken out of screenings and dry heaving in the cinema aisles. And while that is certainly the case, the gore, where it's there, is stomach churning, and everyone around me, myself included, is squirming in our seats. But it shouldn't, I don't think, be overstated. Okay. While it's there, for sure, it's not overused, it's not overdone, and when it's happening, it's happening for a real reason, and you're really seeing this rabid disease take over this girl.
It's not sensational.
It is sensational in that it is outrageous,
yeah,
and you can't quite believe it as it's happening, and you're watching this painstaking process of this girl succumbing to whatever it is that's taken hold of her. But it's not constantly throughout the film. I mean, there's good swathes where there's no gore at all.
Yeah.
It's just suggested. There are even times when the violence occurs off screen and you simply see the aftermath of it, which is nonetheless disgusting, but it's not quite so... It's not gross out necessarily.
Okay.
It's more consequential, I think. But it has an amazing humour to it the entire way through. One of the best things I think about this film is that it is so modern in its representation of every character in that.
Yeah.
You've got male characters, you've got female characters, you've got chaste characters, promiscuous characters. And while we all know the tropes of horror movies, typically if you have sex, you're a goner.
Yeah.
It doesn't follow them,
okay,
but it also, it doesn't fail because of that. It manages to subvert so many horror tropes without losing any of its impact, which throughout I couldn't really believe it was getting away with it. Particularly the lead girl, who doesn't entirely fit that kind of final girl mold. She becomes almost predatory in her sexuality at one point, but doesn't then become a victim because of it.
Okay.
And the idea of what is a victim is also played around with quite a lot. There's people who fall foul of peer pressure and bullying. There's this constant loom of camera phones and maybe the social media can really ruin your reputation, and a social embarrassment. And bloodletting, there is bloodletting, of course, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have to die to be a victim. It plays around with what a victim is.
Okay.
And I think that's really smart, the way it does that, and the way it plays around with that. And also gender representations. There are guys, there are girls, they behave in different ways that are not stereotypical. Sexuality is fluid throughout everyone. It's really smart, it's really modern in that way. And I think it's a really, really great watch. I'd really highly recommend it to anyone. If anybody likes Ginger Snaps, the John Fawcett film.
The Werewolf.
And massive parallels with that film. Okay. Not to its detriment to any degree, because it does quite different things with it. But in the relationship between the lead characters, the kind of the narrative and the consequences that come from this infection, if we call it an infection, there are some similarities here. I think you get a real kick out of it if you're into that film.
Cool. Right on my street. So
it's a really good film.
Ryan Hewitt, Tom Roth, thank you very much for that. Cheers.
Thank you.
Okay, and Raw will be out sometime in 2017. It doesn't have a specific release date for the UK yet, but I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I'm not a big horror guy, as we know, but that sounds absolutely mental, but really excellent as well.
Yeah. So next up, we're going to have Rob Kenny from Head Office talking about The Handmaiden. I saw this just after I saw Monster Calls, and it was a bizarre double bill.
It became a
triple bill as well. That was a strange day. Handmaiden is Park Chan-wook's latest film, and it's everything you want from a Park Chan-wook film. So here's Rob Kenny to talk about The Handmaiden.
Hi there, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Not bad,
excellent.
Not bad.
And you were talking about The Handmaiden, so what did you think about that?
I approached the film screening with huge anticipation, and for once in my life I wasn't disappointed. I thought it was absolutely awesome, film, you know. I'm familiar with Park Chan-wook's previous works, and it's kind of like, you know, when you go to see a film, there's a favourite of yours there, you know, you kind of think, please don't let me down, please don't let me down. And I was so knocked out by this film, so knocked out. It reminded me when the first film of his I ever saw was Old Boy, and it was on in the Edinburgh Film Festival at the time. I can't remember what year it was. But I always remember it was the night after the opening night film, and I can't remember the opening night film was something with Ewan McGregor in, and it was pretty good, you know. And the following morning, you know, there was a press screening of Old Boy at 9 o'clock in the morning, and somebody said, "You've got to see this film; it's fantastic." And I went along, and Old Boy just blew my mind at the time, and it was kind of quite a little bit. It was a little bit crazy watching it at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I've loved his work ever since. So going along to see The Handmaiden, you know, I wasn't disappointed.
Excellent. Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I did a Monster Calls in the morning.
Right.
And then went straight to The Handmaiden. And that was...
Excellent double bill.
Quite bizarre. I was put off at first by how long it was. But this, I think, really earned its length.
But I think, you know, when you're watching a film and you get absorbed into the storyline, and that's the thing that sucked me in. It's very, very stylish. It's very kind of erotic. But the thing that I came away from the film most of all was the storyline, you know, really dragged me into the film. And it's kind of like one of those films where you get to the end of the film and you think, oh, wow, it was like, you know, 2 hours, 20 minutes or 2.5 hours or whatever it was. And the time flies by when you're that absorbed in the film. That's what I found with it.
And it's almost like a kind of pulpy kind of narrative, that kind of sort of double crossing, and it's very dramatic at times. But it's done with that his style as well. It's a nice sort of combination.
Yeah, I mean, there was very, very much Park Chan-wook touches to the film. You know, there was, you know, a colleague of mine had seen the film beforehand, and she just made reference to the octopus scene. And, you know, when I saw the scene where there's a huge octopus in a fish tank behind the guy, I thought, oh my lord, what's going to happen, you know? Because of kind of like associations that with squid in previous films of his. So it was kind of like there's very, very much, you know, touches of previous films and the style of his previous films. But the person that I watched it with also, I thought, made a good point, which was that she described it as very kind of mainstream, but mainstream in a way of it was very approachable. It wasn't, you know, deep and dark, difficult to understand kind of thing. It was kind of very approachable on the surface, which I thought was a really good point when I thought about it afterwards, you know. But there was definitely, most definitely, Park Chan-wook kind of touches to the film and the style about the film,
I think it's a lot more approachable and accessible than Old Boy and some of his previous works.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, Old Boy, you know, the story there is also quite intricate, and you know, you can get kind of suckered into that as well. But I thought, the story was pretty easy to understand and very accessible, like you said. That's a good word, accessible rather than mainstream.
I think a mainstream audience will appreciate it as well as a foreign language audience.
I hope so. I mean, I really kind of like his work. Like I say, Old Boy was the first one that I ever saw, and then that made me go back and see the Vengeance films and stuff like that. And I don't think he's broken out as such in the way that maybe Wong Kar Wai has or something like that. And I think that this is a big opportunity for him. I think that this could be the film that kind of brings him to a wider audience. And I hope that kind of like new people come in and find this film. And you know, it's a really kind of it's got so many elements to it. You know, there's so many aspects to the film that I think will attract people in.
Definitely, yeah, I think it deserves a rewatch as well. Like, you can't get it all in on the first go. Maybe you need to go again and see what you've missed.
Yeah, yeah. It's the same. It's, you know, the same with Old Boy. I must have watched that 10 times over the years, and I'm quite excited about seeing The Handmaiden again. Mm. You know, I'll watch it again. Hopefully, I'll be able to watch it pretty soon again, and I'll enjoy it because I feel that there are many layers to it, and some things I'll have missed the first time round of watching, and I'll find something new every time I go back to it.
And The Handmaiden will be released on the 17th of February in the UK. I really enjoyed it. It's nearly 2.5 hours long, but as we said just then, you don't really feel it. It's got a kind of complex storyline, but one that you're happy to follow. You're happy to find out what's going on. You don't feel like enraged or bored by it.
Mm. And you followed that up with American Honey, which we were both there for.
Yeah.
And that's completely different in that it's very long, but it's not that complex.
No, you're not trying to find someone, but you're just within lost it. Within it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think The Handmaiden, Rob mentions at the end that this could potentially be a very late breakout film almost for Park Chan-wook.
Yeah, I think so. Because like Old Boy is one of those films where it already has its audience. It's a quirky, weird South Korean film that if you're going to see it, you've already seen it. Whereas I think The Handmaiden has quite a story, that kind of story of double crossing and kind of con artists, and also like a sort of erotic thriller type thing that people will recognize and people want to see. So yeah, this could open up Park Chan-wook for a whole new audience, which would be nice.
And I think it was played quite early on in the festival, as with the other two films that we're going to talk about now, that also kind of have these directors that are perhaps a smaller name a few years ago.
Yeah.
And now it's just they're reaching that boiling point.
I think so, yeah.
So J.A. Bayona, who I first knew about from The Orphanage, and that remains one of my favourite horror films of, well, the last 10, 15 years. And now who's going on to do Jurassic World 2 after doing The Impossible as well.
Yeah.
But in between, we've got A Monster Calls, which sadly I couldn't make it, but you managed to.
Yeah, I saw this really early in the morning and I cried. It's a boy whose mother is dying, and the way he deals with that is he sees a giant tree monster voiced by Liam Neeson come to him each night and tell him stories. It's got this kind of BFG type feel to it, but more emotionally intense, more emotionally challenging as well. There's amazing CGI in the film as well. You wouldn't expect that from a film about a boy dealing with death. But yeah, it's incredible. And the way the stories are told to you in this sort of watercolor animation is beautiful. And like Manchester by the Sea, it's another film about how do different people deal with death. And especially this one with a boy at such a young age dealing with his mum, who's played by Felicity Jones, her terminal illness. I really liked this film a lot. And I can't wait to see it again. And that's out on the 1st of January.
Excellent. And Damien Chazelle, another director we've seen go from that indie to massive film rise, but in a very short space of time. I mean, 2 years ago, that was when Whiplash played London Film Festival.
Yeah, played in the 2014 festival. I remember seeing that. I didn't know anything about the film, really. I knew that it was about drumming, and it had J.K. Simmons in it. That was it. And then by the end of the film, I was almost shaking, because that ends so sort of exciting and not like something you've never seen before.
Mm. And he really continues that kind of last 10 minutes that completely smashes it. In La La Land, the whole film is just a joy. The screen that I was in, it was felt like a communal experience. The credits come up and you get an opening song made up of people dressed in primary colours all sitting in their cars that gradually start getting out of them and doing this amazing number. They finish and the title card La La Land comes up and 400 people in the room that I was in just burst into applause. And that's such an amazing, wow, amazing thing to have in a cinema experience rather than a theatre, yeah, experience. But that's what La La Land is. And it's going back to that time when going out to the cinema was a theatre experience.
Theatrical, yeah, yeah.
And you would dress up for it and it would be, it's almost that kind of what would have been a water cooler moment as well. And it is going to be that in 2 months' time, yeah, when it comes out.
It will come out on the 13th of January, same weekend as Manchester by the Sea. And La La Land Oscars, can you see that happening?
Definitely. It's got, okay, it's got everything that the Academy normally go for. It's kind of films about films, yeah, films about Hollywood. It almost feels like a period piece because of how much it feels like an old, yeah, film, even, okay, though it's set now. And it almost takes you out of it when Emma Stone will like answer or a text or something.
Yeah.
You think, oh yeah, this is set now. And you do forget that. And I think that's part of the film, that it is nostalgic and it's reaching into the past. And then occasionally it will draw you up on that and say, nah, this is now.
Excellent. So we've discussed two fairly mainstream films-ish just then. But Michael Garrad from Curzon Head Office, he discussed two smaller films. Those were Boundaries and The Death of Louis the 14th. So here are his thoughts on those.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm great. Okay, so I've seen a number of films. I work in the events team. My selection is often rather partial because it's to do with the films that have been showing at Curzon Cinemas. Yeah. I'll be kind of based at one of the venues, or I'll be kind of going between the venues. So and we've had a great selection of films selected for Curzon venues this year, really wide range. We've had a few of the experimental films selected at Soho. It's always good to get a breadth of the programme represented at our cinemas. The films that I've seen that I'd like to mention that I enjoyed, the first one I saw, which was shown at Mayfair, it's called Boundaries, mm-hmm, which is a French-Canadian comedy drama, which is based around sort of a municipal dispute, and the actual portrayal of that municipal dispute is actually extremely detailed, but the filming of it is really very kind of composed and very sort of restrained and very stylish. It's got this wonderful jazz soundtrack, and it's sort of these kind of on the face of it kind of, you know, sort of mundanities are sort of behind it, and you see something into the people's lives, but it's very it's not overwrought. It's extremely kind of contained, and I think it's a really interesting film, really amazing cinematography, and kind of almost, I guess, made me think somehow, which is a completely different kind of film, but of the James Benning film Landscape Suicide, where you see these sorts of, you know, these the themes of the films are very different, but these sort of very composed images of landscapes and houses and, you know, roads and things like that, but then, you know, what these very composed kind of very particular sort of structures are actually sort of what the emotional stuff is behind it, and I thought that was a really really interesting film. Really pleased to see it. The probably the best film I've seen so far at the festival is The Death of Louis the 14th, which is being distributed by New Wave, directed by Albert Serra, and stars Jean-Pierre Léaud as Louis the 14th on his deathbed. Jean-Pierre Léaud, of course, known for his youthful performances in French New Wave films, in particularly in the 60s. Now is, yes, 70-year-old, and he's wearing these extraordinary wigs, and he's in sort of a almost barely moves for for nearly 2 hours. He says a few words and it's sort of like a very gradual decline. It's quite an interesting film, I think, after seeing, for example, a different film about death, obviously, a few years ago, was a more one that's sort of like a very realistic depiction of the slow decline of someone. I think that the almost setting of it with this historical figure in these very lavish kind of, you know, outfits and so on, almost kind of makes the you know, the fact of this slow death, you know, almost kind of more more apparent. And I think that anybody who has experienced that, which is everybody, has experienced, you know, someone going through this, or what, you know, most people have, can really see that sort of that kind of steady decline, and when is the moment going to be, and so on, and this sort of the helplessness of the people around. I thought it was really beautiful, really interesting use of occasional use of music. There's one bit where there's a classical piece that I can never quite point what it is, but and Jean-Pierre Léaud is kind of just sat in his bed, and he's almost just staring beyond the camera for almost like 3 or 4 minutes, and it's just a static shot, barely any movement, and then this sort of this music, and it's sort of a, I think it kind of marks like a turning point when you know that, you know, the point of no return. But yeah, I thought it was, that was really extraordinary. And they're my tips for the top. I think I'll leave it at that. There are some other ones, but they're the ones that I felt that's biggest thumbs perfect. Up for. Yeah. All right.
Okay, so that's Michael Garrod. Thank you very much for that. Cheers.
Cheers.
Okay. Michael Garrod there, talking about Boundaries and the death of Louis XIV. Jake, you saw Eglantine.
Yeah, so Michael mentioned in there that it was great to have something from the Experimenta strand playing at Soho. And he's right, that is it. Although these festivals are wonderful for watching these films that are going to go and get Oscars or are going to be playing next year, there's also films that are going to be playing here that are waiting to get distribution. And it could well be that a film plays at London Film Festival and that's the only time it's going to play, because it is something that's more experimental. Yeah. And this is your chance to watch something and have an experience that perhaps no one else will have. And so I went to a film in the Experimenta strand called Eglantine, directed by Margaret Salmon. And this is a kind of children's documentary fairy tale experience. It's very reflexive at the beginning. It's Margaret and her children kind of trying to film a badger hole, and then as they go to sleep after they finish filming for the day, one of her daughters stays awake and kind of goes out into the woods and explores the nature that's around there. And that acts as a vessel for this kind of planet Earth, but 35mm amazing imagery of different birds and octopuses and beetles and lots of really amazing nature footage. And it was a really intimate, hand-spun version of Voyage of Time.
Wow. That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's really worth checking out.
And on a completely different note, we both saw Bleed for This.
Yeah.
On I think it was on a Saturday afternoon, which was quite a nice time to see it. This is probably the most mainstream film of the festival.
Or Snowden, maybe as well.
Maybe Snowden, but just in terms of like style, genre, content.
Yeah,
stars.
Convention.
Yeah. So this is a boxing film, true story. And it does follow the boxing film conventions. You know how it's going to end. But this was a pretty good one, I thought. Starring Miles Teller, Kieran Hines, pretty good cast. We both enjoyed it, didn't we?
Yeah, and the boxing film is it's almost gone the way of the Western as well.
Yeah, it's definitely.
And so we've had recent stuff like Grudge Match or Southpaw, which people just said, what's the point?
Yeah.
Like, it's the same thing over and over again. And then Creed earlier this year or late last year really injected something new into that. And Bleed for This manages to sort of tread that line of convention but comes out okay on the other side.
Yeah, there's some nice stuff about the body in the film as well, and injury, and there's some moments that are you're quite uncomfortable watching.
Yeah, I mean, there's some proper body horror stuff in there.
Definitely. So yeah, that's Bleed for This. That's going to be out on the 2nd of December. Really fun, really enjoyable film. And then I saw Nocturnal Animals, the latest Tom Ford film starring Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal. This one has a very strange premise where Amy Adams is an artist in LA and she receives a manuscript for a novel from her ex-husband. And he says, this book is sort of inspired by you. I want you to read it first. And so she starts to read the book. And then the middle part of the film is the visualization of the book. And every now and then it cuts out to real life. And she starts to think maybe he's trying to tell me something through this book. I think it's isn't quite hold up to that premise. Because that's a really great premise, I thought. And at times it feels like there's two very good films that have been slightly uncomfortably pushed together. But it's a Tom Ford film, so it looks incredible. Amy Adams and Jake Gyllenhaal, it seems standard to say they're very good, but they are in here really doing great performances.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I just wished maybe narratively it was a bit tighter and it had a bit more to do with those two narrative strands, but yeah. That's going to be out on the 4th of November, so very soon.
I'm looking forward to watching that because I couldn't get there in time to watch this because I know it was a very busy show as well.
It's definitely intriguing.
Okay.
I recommend watching it because I think a lot of people do like it and I think a lot of people will like it. It's just for me those two things didn't quite work together, but there's a lot in there to like anyway. Okay. So next up we have Ali Clough from the Curzon Hill Office, and he's going to be talking about Ascent, Arrival and A Quiet Passion.
Hello, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. So what's really taken you aback this year at the London Film Festival? What are your highlights?
Well, I've been lucky enough to see quite a few films this year, but I'd say I've got three highlights. The first being a film called Ascent, by Fiona Tan, and it's a sort of a photo film essay about visual representations of Mount Fuji in Japan, and it's really a film which is sort of a mood poem almost to that particular place, and it consists of a series of images, of pictures, of photographs, of paintings of Mount Fuji, and how monument has affected and has impacted on the sort of culture and the people of Japan. And it sort of, you get montages of photographs, you get, it's always still, there's no sort of moving images as such, so it's kind of a strange film because there's not any, as far as I remember, moving images. It's a selection of stills. But in that regard, it's very arresting because it's not like anything you normally watch on the big screen. And there's a sort of overarching narrative between a man and a woman who are sort of neither addressing each other, nor are they sort of two separate either. It's a bit like Hiroshima Mon Amour, the Alan Rinne film, which is actually sort of talked about briefly in the film. And yeah, you just go in and you've sort of got to be in the right mood for a film like that. I mean, I love sort of these essay films, which are sort of a very sort of thin, slight, but overarching narrative on what the film is trying to say. There's not a plot as such to the film, just some sort of slowly seeping arguments as to the themes of the film. But that was really, really good.
Cool.
My sort of second choice is a film called Arrival,
yep.
Which is going to be a very, very big film, I think. It's sort of a bit like a sort of Christopher Nolan blockbuster. Denis Villeneuve directs, who's done Sicario, Prisoners, Enemy from our very own Curzon Artificial Eye stable. And it's sort of got all the blockbustery elements of modern day sort of films. It's a sci-fi, it's got star power, Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and Forest Whitaker. And the main premise is the world has not been taken over, but there has been 12 alien pods that have landed throughout Earth, and all the sort of the nations affected, their militaries and their sort of secret police, etc., are now trying to investigate these alien pods and trying to sort of communicate with them as to why they're here. And Forrest Whitaker plays a high-ranking military officer, and his two experts that he chooses to try and get real knowledge and information from these pods are Jeremy Renner and Amy Adams, who plays sort of one of the world's leading experts on language. And what follows is a really, really innovative journey into, you know, if aliens did really come down to Earth, how would we communicate to them? What language would they use? Do they use words? Do they use sounds? In this instance, they use visuals, and these very, very arresting sort of pieces of art almost, which Amy Adams sort of tries and is able to then comprehend and try and pass the knowledge up to her superiors. As I say, it's got all the hallmarks of a great sort of modern day Chris Nolan blockbuster, very beautiful images, an amazing sound design, great, great acting by the three leads. And it was just great, and I think it will do really, really well, especially for Curzon Cinemas when it gets released.
Excellent. And did you want to talk about Quiet Passion?
Yeah, but perhaps my favourite film of the festival that I've seen is Terence Davis's A Quiet Passion. Terence Davis seems to be in a bit of a renaissance period at the moment. He was, you know, a real sort of British auteur director in the 80s and 90s. And sort of, you know, took a bit of time off. Returned a few years ago with Of Time in the City, a well-regarded sort of, again, essay film on his hometown of Liverpool. Since then, Deep Blue Sea, Sunset Song, these great films rooted in a certain period, and A Quiet Passion is also a period piece sort of dealing with the life of the American poet Emily Dickinson. And much like a lot of Terence Davis's work, we've got sort of an artistic firebrand of a person sort of constrained by their social conditions, by their the sort of religious culture of that time, by the a familial culture of that time, really controlled by the sort of a paternal or a patriarchy, should I say. But he treats the subject with great respect. So regardless of who thinks about what, and if someone is very, very pious or if someone is very, very free, the cinema of Terence Davis tends not to judge. He just lets the characters sort of express what they need to express. So Emily Dickinson doesn't necessarily come off as heroic for the type of person she is, nor does she come off as particularly lost or forlorn. But her increasing sort of reclusivity is addressed, and it's sort of, is she more of a poet than she is devoted to her family? You know, Emily Dickinson the poet, or Emily Dickinson the sort of part of the family, the cog of the family that keeps it going? These things are never sort of wholly closed off. Great performances by Cynthia Nixon as Emily Dickinson, and Jennifer L as her sister. And it's, again, like Sunset Song, very, very beautifully shot. I think it was shot in the original home of Emily Dickinson in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And it's got a real great period feel to it. It uses a mix of sort of European classical composers' music with sort of Charles Ives, really amazing sort of American folk classical music to really delve into that period feel. And yeah, it sort of blew me away. I was speaking to a few people after the screening. Likewise, they were very moved by it. So yeah, I really hope that will do well and it's picked up as well.
Okay, and we can expect arrival on the 10th of November.
Is that when we can expect it to
arrive? And then A Quiet Passion will be out on the 18th of November. Got a pun for that one, have you?
No, but I think Ali's delightful tones were quietly passionate okay. about it.
Very good. Jake, what did you see?
Right, so going on from something very small like A Quiet Passion to something impossibly big, mm-hmm. Which is Terrence Malick's Voyage of Time. And I saw the version entitled Voyage of Time, Life's Journey. But there is also Voyage of Time, the IMAX experience. These are two different films. One is 90 minutes long, one is 40 minutes long. Mm-hmm. The 90-minute version that I saw is narrated by Cate Blanchett, and the shorter IMAX version is narrated by Brad Pitt. This is a very much a passion project for Malick. He's been working on it since he started Badlands, really. This is a documentary about everything. That's it, really. It's the beginning to the end of the universe. And in an hour and a half, I think that's a pretty impressive feat. I know you're definitely a Malick skeptic.
I am. Sam. I just think it's so Malicky to think you can make a documentary about everything.
Yeah.
But apparently it worked.
Yeah, so. I think it really worked. The thing that didn't work for me was the Cate Blanchett narration. He layers on verbal poetry. Okay. Onto the film that has no need to be there because the music and the visuals work for themselves. Okay. And we all know he loves his narration.
Yeah.
But for me, it didn't need to be there. It's very on the nose. The message that of this kind of astounding beauty of nature that comes through in the dialogue, it doesn't need to be there because the images that he creates are so stunning and so kind of take you back that it just doesn't need to be there. And it is the best looking film that I've seen this year. It is beyond belief how good these images are. They're so crisp and sharp and you have no idea where the CGI is coming in. There's some stuff that almost looks like miniatures that look like ink being dropped in water to create galaxies. But you're astounded by the creation of the images along with the images themselves. It's a really, really amazing film. And I'm going to definitely check out the IMAX version as well.
That has Brad Pitt.
Yeah, because I wonder whether they differ the narration and whether that will be a different experience.
Okay. Also this year, one of the big talking point films of the year, possibly for the wrong reasons, is Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation, which is the sort of passion project from Nate Parker, who wrote, directed, produced, and stars in the film as Nat Turner, who was a slave in the South of America in the 1800s, who led a slave rebellion against the white slave owners. I liked the film. I think that it's very conventional. It relies a lot on emotional manipulation. And someone described it to me as Braveheart with slaves, which I think I agree with. But there's moments of power in there that really overwhelm you in a good way. So for me overall, I'd say it was a very good film, if not a bit sloppy in its storytelling and its characterization. And he does he makes certain narrative choices that I won't go into now that I think, I don't know why you've done this, because it's changed the film in an unnecessary way in certain points. But I think as a debut feature, it's successful. if not a bit generic at times. So next up, we have Irena talking about Patterson, which you saw.
Yeah, Patterson is one of like my top highlights of the festival. And Irena will speak far better about it than I will. I admit I don't know a huge amount about poetry. I know a little bit. I know the Jabberwocky. Or at least the first verse of it. Adam Driver plays a bus driver / poet named Patterson in this town of Patterson. And it's very Jarmusch-y. It's very slow. It doesn't really change its pace at all. There's little drama in it. And I think the massive achievement in the film is having a character who is a poet that is not completely insufferable.
Okay, so here is Irena talking about Patterson, as well as Javier Dolan's It's Only the End of the World, and Paul Verhoeven's Elle.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. So what were your highlights from LFF 2016?
So my highlights, there's sort of three top films that have really impressed me. First one is Patterson, which is a really easy film to love because it's very gentle on the surface. Still waters do run very deep in this film. It's got a really kind of gentle watercolor-like aspect to it, and it's a very soft, sweet story. But I think there's a lot of it that's behind the surface underneath. And it's really a return to form from Jim Jarmusch. I really loved Only Lovers Left Alive, but
yeah,
it's
the vampire film.
Yeah, it was a while since I'd seen a Jim Jarmusch film that really felt like a Jim Jarmusch film, back to, you know, his top quality. It's a film that fans of American poetry would love, but I also had this experience of sitting next to a friend and colleague who didn't know any of the poets who are referenced in the film. And he loved it just as much as I did, who I'm obsessed with Frank O'Hara, William Carlos Williams, many of the poets that are referenced in the film. It's kind of a little blue collar story. There's a lot in it that reminded me of my absolute hero, Bruce Springsteen, as I'm sure you will find out when you read my piece on the Curzon magazine. And I think it's really one of my contestants for the film of the year.
Wow.
So straightforward, 5 stars from me, or rather 5 blue hearts.
And this is Adam Driver in the lead.
Yeah. Adam Driver in the lead. Yeah, it's a superb performance from him. It's very rich, very subtle. There's a lot of it, again, that is not explained, but you can really... There's a lot that Jarmusch does to set up the character, and you can really figure out a backstory for this character if you're interested. Okay. So it's really hard to describe this film without using the word poetic, because the work of it is really about making sure that the surface is very accessible and very simple. But what's underneath is layers and layers and layers, and it's the same with this character. So it's fascinating.
Excellent.
My other two picks are kind of two much more difficult films to talk about. One is Xavier Dolan's It's Only the End of the World, which was very weirdly panned at its Cannes premiere. I say very weirdly because I think that people have chosen to sort of ridicule the fact that he's so young and so talented. Yeah. And it's really easy to go for that, slamming someone who's trying to do something very ambitious. And I think he really does display a great directorial fingerprint over the whole film. The story is about this writer who has been estranged from his family for quite a long time. He's quite young. There are reasons why he's estranged from his family, which are not immediately apparent, but he does reveal in the very first opening moment of the film that he's going home to tell his family that he's dying.
Quite
why or how remains a thing for people to discover or to indeed have ideas about. And what follows is this very, very intense 24 hours with his family, where they have this meal, which is a kind of trademark artificial eye film, dinner party where people really bring on the hatred and the intensity. And the whole film is kind of shot with incredible command. The dialogue is very, very tight. It's an adaptation from a theatrical script, from a play, and it really does show there's a lot of overlapping dialogues, and it's orchestrated very, very well. And it's all shot in close-ups.
which means that you are really thrown in very intensely, very deeply into this conversation that you're experiencing. And eventually, because underneath all of this is a secret that needs to be revealed, there is an explosion. But whether that explosion does become revelatory or not is very questionable. So I think it's a very it's a film that has great impact on the viewer.
Yeah.
And it's a hard watch, but it's fascinating. It's a pure talent of work, and I would watch anything that Xavier Dolan will continue to do, as indeed I've watched everything that he's done so far.
Excellent, that sounds great.
Yeah, and then finally, another film I really, enjoyed, is that the right word? I am not sure, is Elle by Paul Verhoeven. Possibly the most controversial film of the festival, most controversial film of next year, I'd be not surprised. It's a film that I didn't know anything about going in. I just knew it was hashtag problematic. And it is a rape revenge comedy, if such a thing can exist. Now, the crucial word in all of this is not rape or comedy, it's revenge.
Okay.
And revenge, as we know, is best served in certain very particular ways. And I think that this film really hooks on to this idea of what do you do when you have been the victim of something so extreme and so terrifying, and you discover something about it and about yourself. So it's an incredibly brave film. Isabelle Huppert is the main character in it. And she is, as we know, fantastic in these roles where she's kind of a woman pushed to very extreme situations, particularly where sexuality is involved. But also she's someone who's always very much in control of her characters and the direction they take. And that really shows in this film. There are some genuine laughs. I mean, I would hugely recommend seeing this film in a packed cinema, because I think you really need those laughs to understand what Verhoeven is trying to do.
Okay.
There are also some incredibly shocking moments. I mean, this film should have trigger warnings all over it. It is explicit, it's violent, and it sort of uses thriller and shock horror techniques to keep you on your toes, to remind you that this may be funny at times, but actually there is something within it that is very deep and disturbing again. So it's a really, it's a film I'd invite people to go and see, provided that they don't have a problem with the premise to begin with, which I can see is tough and difficult. But I think there's a very intelligent filmmaker at work there, and it's really worth having a conversation about it.
Right. Is it a return to form for Verhoeven, do you think? Or
I don't know that he's ever been out of form. I mean, in his own peculiar ways. Yeah. He is, I think, a much more sophisticated director than people assume. And I think he knows exactly what he's doing.
Okay.
And when he's being trashy, there's a reason why he's being trashy. So I enjoyed Black Books, which was one of his recent films.
Okay.
And I think there's something that fans of that film will find here. But also it's kind of it's sort of Verhoeven trying to do Haneke, if you can imagine such a thing.
Wow, okay.
So there's a lot in it about a sort of critique of the middle classes or the darker sides of the French bourgeoisie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of references to Buñuel too, which I always appreciate in a filmmaker. So welcome back, Paul Verhoeven.
Excellent, that sounds like a must watch. Okay, great. So, Irena, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, so there we go. That was Irena talking about Patterson, which is released on the 25th of November. It's Only the End of the World, which is released on the 14th of April. And then Elle, which is released on the 24th of February. Coming up in a few weeks' time, we're going to be talking about Anne Fontaine's The Innocents, which I saw last week at the festival. We've got an interview with her. The Innocents is about a Red Cross doctor in Poland in 1945, just after the war, who discovers a convent of nuns where some of the nuns are pregnant. You find out why they're pregnant, and then she eventually comes to look after them. Really amazing film, devastating and beautiful. It's a lot of it sort of shot in that sort of snowy winters of Poland. Really amazing visuals.
And we've got an interview with
An interview. I interviewed Anne Fontaine as well for that, yeah. So that'll be a good week. She had a lot to say about the film as well, which is always good. And then I also saw Christine. So Christine stars Rebecca Hall as Christine Chubbuck, who was a news reporter in the 70s who committed suicide live on television. It's a true story. Again, this is one that I feel like more people should have heard of, but it was completely new to me.
I think perhaps it's a bit more known in America.
Yeah, possibly. So this was a relatively small film, but I mean, really cynical film. But that is not a criticism at all. I thought the film was pretty extraordinary in its discussion of sort of femininity and sort of women in the workplace and things just like the shattering of the American dream for certain people. And Rebecca Hall's performance is absolutely extraordinary. She doesn't try too hard to sell Christine as a likable character or as too much of a victim either. It's a really nice balance. And I hope the film is released in time for Oscars because I think she really deserves one.
Yeah, Rebecca Hall is always kind of been on that cusp of something
great.
Yeah,
she was launched in The Prestige, I think was her big film, and then she's kind of teetered around. I mean, even when she's been in things like Iron Man 3, she's not really had much to do.
Transcendence.
Yeah, Transcendence. I mean, she was very good in The Gift, I thought. But again, not many people saw that.
No.
So I'm hoping this could pique a lot more people's interest in her career because she does an absolutely extraordinary job here.
Excellent. And that kind of uneasiness takes us nicely into Oliver Assayas's Personal Shopper, which is another collaboration with Kristen Stewart. And this, I was really, really taken aback by. I thought this was excellent. I shamefully had gotten up that morning and I'd kind of just drawn a blank on what Personal Shopper was about. I kind of had it in my head that this was Kristen Stewart in some kind of comment on fame and celebrity and consumerism and that kind of detached nature.
That's what I assumed it would be as well.
And so the film starts, this is like 9 o'clock in the morning as well, and she's walking up to these gothic gates and so is this... This is the film I'm thinking of, isn't it? And then the words Personal Shopper come up in massive red letters. And then I just suddenly had it all come back to me. It's like, oh, yeah, it's that horror film. Okay, of course. And then we kind of get her going up to this big empty house that was for her dead brother's house. And you get this kind of Michael Haneke haunted house feel, kind of flavours of The Witch in terms of what is real and what's not. And you get these really tense moments of texting. If you're a fan of the sound effects of iMessage, this is the real film for you. Like, there's a lot of that just...
Well, finally.
Yeah.
I've been searching for ages.
Yeah. There's good kind of 20 to 25 minutes where the main focus of the film is Kristen Stewart's hand texting. So top stuff for hand fans, iMessage fans, and Ghost fans.
So speaking of Kristen Stewart, she also starred in Kelly Reichardt's latest film Certain Women, which Kate Garover is going to discuss for you now. But before that, she also talks about Letters from Baghdad. So this is Kate Garover and our last visit to Curzon head office.
Okay, and we are now joined by Kate Garover. So Kate, what are your highlights from LFF 2016?
Well, I've seen a lot of the big movies, as is always the way with LFF, the ones that have queues around the door, including La La Land. But what's great about the festival are all the sort of smaller gems that you can find. And I didn't get into one film that I wanted to see. And it so happened that the producer was hanging around one of the cinemas and she said, well, come and see my film. And so I said, okay. And that was Letters from Baghdad. And I had almost, I really didn't have a great deal of knowledge of what the film was about. And it's about this woman called Gertrude Bell, who obviously sounds like she should be part of the Virginia Woolf set. And I think she was around that time. And she was this incredible pioneering woman who shaped modern Middle East after the First World War. And she basically grew up in a very privileged family, mm-hmm. and then went on holiday and ended up in sort of Iraq. I presume that's what you did in the sort of 20s, I don't really know. And but she really fell in love with the Middle East. She had a couple of sort of love affairs that left her with a broken heart, and basically ended up sort of devoting her life to the Middle East and living there and being very influential in how it was sort of shaped with the king coming in. And she was quite influential with people like Winston Churchill and Lawrence Arabia. So she was very much kind of admired, and there's lots of photos, a lot of footage and photos of her sort of atop, sitting atop a camel, and it's just her, the lone woman, with like kind of loads of other men. So it's really a sort of essay, reconstruction, documentary, and with loads of great photography from that time. I thought that it was wonderful in the way that it took you back to this era and how sort of modern she was and how brave she was. And also, I think it's a kind of, for me personally, I think that there are so many pioneering women stories that are not told on screen. And so it made a kind of really welcome and enjoyable, refreshing change.
Excellent. Great.
I also saw Certain Women by Kelly Reichardt. Love Kelly Reichardt. I think once you find her, she is somebody that then is a director that is very much admired. So she has sort of her kind of Reichardt groupies. And Certain Women is a film, and it's based on some short stories. And I don't think I've ever quite seen short stories translated to the screen in their purest form, i.e. you feel like the short story is just like you're reading it on screen in a way. And all three tales are about different women at different points in their lives, and they're about loneliness. I think they're all actually about loneliness. I think that's kind of the defining theme. And it's very hard to sell in a Kelly Reichardt film because it's not a traditional narrative. It's not so linear that you can say, this is it, here's the story arc, here's how it finishes. But in its whole, it's a beautiful, restrained piece of filmmaking that speaks volumes in its quietness.
Okay. Certain Women there, which won Best Film for the festival. I think it probably deserves a rewatch from me because I had literally just seen Manchester by the Sea and I was so knocked back by that. But then to see this, which is so subtle and so quiet and relaxed, it was quite a difference.
Yeah, Manchester by the Sea really affected my viewing as well because I watched La La Land and was then totally ready to go into Manchester by the Sea and like ready to cry my eyes out. But La La Land had me on such a high
mood.
Manchester by the Sea just kind of leveled me out.
I see. So finally, we're going to talk about the last film, the closing film of the festival, and this is Ben Wheatley's Free Fire. This is a film I've been looking forward to seeing for ages. It's great being a Ben Wheatley fan because he produces and directs so many films closely together that there's not a lot of time to wait around.
Yeah, and there's a lot of parallels between our experience now and exactly what we were doing a year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
we watched High Rise. We got in kind of last minute.
Yeah.
And then it was actually about 5 months before we actually had the chance to see the film again.
Yeah.
And for you, that film really shifted on that.
Yeah, when I first saw High Rise last year, I thought it was a fine piece of filmmaking, very messy, very all over the place. I didn't care about the characters at all, really. And I thought, yeah, that was okay. And then seeing it again when it was it March or April it was released?
I think it's end of March, maybe.
Yeah, publicly. I thought it was amazing. It's definitely in my top 10 of the year. So that's the benefit of, I guess, seeing something then having a nice break from it and then going again with different expectations. And then we got into Free Fire. The queue for Free Fire for the press screening was incredible. I think I just about...
I think it was the only press show of that day at that time. Yeah, so exactly. It was the thing that every single person was going to.
So yeah, Free Fire is a world away from High Rise in terms of its scale and its themes, whereas that was a very sort of heady adaptation of a J.G. Ballard novel, which was so layered and intricate. This is a shootout.
Yeah, I think this film is excellent. I really loved it. I hadn't seen any of the trailers, which I feel like may have benefited me.
I think it probably did.
I knew it was a gun trade gone wrong in Boston.
Yep.
That's all I knew. And I knew the cast members. And so I was really excited because the cast is phenomenal. Charlton Copley, Cillian Murphy, Michael Smiley, Brie Larson, Enzo Colenti,
Jack Rayner.
Yeah, it's a fantastic cast. And I just had an absurd amount of fun with this film.
And I think that's... I'm going to try not to be mistaken for disliking this film because I did really like it. I think it's the most fun you're going to have in a film around whenever this is released. This is released 31st of March.
Weekend, this is the most fun you'll have in the cinema on the weekend of the 31st of March next year.
I mean, around that time, I can't think of anything that could possibly equate to this in terms of just sheer enjoyment.
Yeah,
it's a perfect 90 minutes. If you love action films, you'll love it. If you don't, I think you'll still enjoy it.
Oh yeah, it's funny enough that you don't... like the gunshots are done really well.
Yeah.
Like Ben Wheatley said so many times about the way that he makes films is that when other people cut away, he'll leave the camera going.
Yeah, and that's what you have here.
Yeah,
you see them just hitting walls rather than each other.
Yeah.
So my reservation with Free Fire was that I had seen the trailers, I knew what the film was. I knew it was a gun sale gone wrong, and the whole film was pretty much set in this one building, and it was a shootout. And I knew that it was going to be that. I thought, oh, that's going to be really fun. Maybe not too challenging or too... there's not going to be a lot to talk about afterwards, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And I went in with that expectation, and for me, that's all I got.
Yeah.
Which isn't a bad thing, but for me, it is just a fun shootout film.
Yeah, I suppose when we watch trailers and posters and things now, you want that to be a tease, and then the final product gives you something more.
You want it to be more. For me, there wasn't much more than what I thought.
Yeah,
and it at times I thought it was a little bit of a Tarantino impression.
I don't think that at all. No,
I just think you've got a bunch of over-exaggerated criminals in a room shooting each other. There's extreme violence and also snappy, smart dialogue.
But Tarantino will have like people's faces explode for no reason and people fly everywhere. And on this, when people get shot, it's just like, oh God, like they've just been shot and they don't really mind that much. And they just kind of drag themselves across the floor and everyone is just on the floor. They've been shot in the leg or the shoulder and they're just like grubbly trying to pull themselves around. And it's really unglamorous, which is, I think, the polar opposite of the way that Tarantino shoots violence.
Yeah, there was just something so Reservoir Dogs about parts of the film.
Just because it's a warehouse.
Well, I think that's unavoidable.
Yeah.
And that's not... I like Tarantino, and I like Reservoir Dogs. And this was a very good companion piece.
And I said to you after we watched it that Ben Wheatley probably would have been around 20, 25 when this would have...
Yeah.
When Reservoir Dogs would have been coming out.
Yeah, so this isn't a criticism of the film. It's just my way. I don't see it as being a major point of Ben Wheatley's career.
Is it? Do you think it's exactly the sum of its parts?
Exactly. It's exactly what it wants to be. And exactly all it is what it needs to be and what it wants to be.
Yeah.
And I think he probably maybe isn't trying to do anything more than be a fun shootout Tarantino-esque film.
And I think after High Rise, which is such a heavy...
Exactly, yeah. And because he makes films, seems like he makes them so quickly, it's probably quite nice to have one that's so simple.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the credit has to be given to the production management on this film, because it is to figure out where everyone needs to be in this, because people are constantly moving around the warehouse.
To maintain continuity as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I know Ben Wheatley and Amy Jump edited it together.
Which I think helps if you've written it and directed it and then go on to edit it. You're so in that film, you know exactly where everyone is.
Yeah.
And I think that helps.
Because it could easily be really confusing, but you do actually, you can tell who's on whose side and when, and the characters are part of that confusion because they accidentally shoot each other as well.
Definitely. Big shout out to Charlton Copley.
Stills
who
it.
Absolutely chews the scenery and he must have a very sore jaw after this film. He is an amazing character, but he's the character that you expect Charlton Copley to play. And that's why I think the film matches your expectations rather than pushes them.
Definitely.
And it's a strange film for the festival to end with, we were saying.
Yeah, because last year we opened with Suffragette, closed with Steve Jobs. Yeah. Your kind of big actory biopic that's going for Oscars. Yeah. Free Fire is, I think, actually, in some sense, a nice way to end, because it's just a big bit of fun.
Yeah, that's what you want from the end of a film. So what you get with United Kingdom is a very grand film to open you in, and but also kind of grand, but also kind of soft. Mm. Whereas Free Fire is quite harsh and hard, but fun. Mm. So yeah, they're quite a nice bookend in a way. Right, so that's it. The end of the festival, the end of our reviews. We're just going to end with our favourite film of the festival. So start with you.
I'm going to be really uncool. It's La La Land.
Yeah?
Yeah. It is just, for me, it's the best film I've watched this year. And it's just a complete joy.
I'm quite annoyed I didn't get a chance to see it at the festival. But it is quite nice having the anticipation leading up to when it's out. Mm. And I hope it does that for me, what it did for you.
Yeah.
My favourite film was Manchester by the Sea, I think it's got to be, because it was just, it's so perfect in everything that it does. And every performance, every little shot, every time you sort of see parts of where it's set, the Manchester in America, it's a really nice addition to all the characters and their feelings. Incredible. But another big shout out to Handmaiden, which was really fun.
Yeah, I think there's so many on there.
I didn't see anything that I hated.
No.
Everything was, I would recommend to someone.
Yeah, and I think there'll be a lot there that I'll be watching again when they come out.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's quite nice that most of the things that are released at the end of this year or the beginning of next year still will be out soon. So we're going to have a shout out to a big thank you to the 7 people at the Curls and Artificial Eye head offices. That was a big help lending us their voices, so you didn't just hear us drone on for an hour or so.
Yep. Thanks a lot to the BFI for putting this festival on.
Absolutely.
Claire Stewart, who joined us on the podcast as well a couple of weeks ago, which was great to have her on.
Okay, so that's it for this year. Hopefully we'll be back next year with some more London Film Festival roundup stuff. So that's a goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
That's goodbye from me. Goodbye. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.